Hello, welcome to First State Insights, a podcast presented by the University of Delaware's Institute for Public Administration. We call ourselves IPA for short. My name is Julia O'Hanlon, and I'm a staff member with IPA. We're part of the Biden School of Public Policy and Administration here at the University of Delaware. During this episode, my colleague Sean O'Neill and I are joined by Dr. Omar Khan and Tim Gibbs, both with the Delaware Academy of Medicine and Delaware Public Health Association. Dr. Khan is currently the CEO and president of the Delaware Health Sciences Alliances. He is a practicing physician with interest in general primary care, medical education, and global health. Tim Gibbs currently serves as the director of the Delaware Academy of Medicine and Delaware Public Health Association. He has dedicated his professional career to the nonprofit sector and human services delivery. Our conversation took place on August 22nd and focused on current health and social policy challenges, particularly related to social determinants of health, including affordable housing. Enjoy the conversation. So good morning. I am joined today with my colleague, Sean O'Neill, and we are really pleased to have with us this morning, Dr. Omar Khan and Tim Gibbs. And we're going to have a conversation about some relevant things going on here in Delaware related to health, healthcare, health policy, social determinants of health, some information about the clinical side of life and how that relates to other areas, including housing. So I just want to welcome you both and thank you for joining us today. If you wanted to just kind of quickly introduce yourself, Tim, and tell our audience a little bit about yourself, and then we can shoot it over to Dr. Khan.
Sure. So I'm the executive director of the Delaware Academy of Medicine and the Delaware Public Health Association. I'm a Delaware native, so this is home state for me. However, I am born of Canadian parents, so I'm one of those sort of a native foreigner, if you will. Went to Wilmington Friends School, so had a Quaker education for 12 years, which definitely has influenced my worldview and my practice and actions throughout my career. I started off wanting to go to medical school, got diverted, ended up building houses, ironically, ended up being the director of Delaware's first hospice and transitional care facility for people with HIV. And then it's a long story from there, but ended up sort of back in medicine and public health with the Academy DPHA. Thanks for having me.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning, Julia and Sean. Thank you again for the opportunity to be here today. I very much enjoy hearing about Tim's background, and especially because we have so much to learn from each other. And it's been a pleasure working with Tim over the last many years and as part of the Delaware Academy of Medicine and Delaware Public Health Association. I do share some background with Tim as well. We actually went to the same high school, Wilmington Friends School, locally. In barring a piece that our neighbors to the north have done, regardless of where we happen to be at this point, we happen to be on the Delaware PA border. So acknowledging that the land we currently occupy was that occupied by the Lenape and the Nanticoke, among other nations in the past. So starting off with that, you know, my background is in medicine and in public health. I've always been interested in the interplay between the two, especially in global health and health policy and health systems. I serve as president and CEO of the Delaware Health Sciences Alliance, which is a group knitting together universities, academic medical centers, and associations, including the Delaware Academy of Medicine, DPHA. I've also served as past president of the Delaware Academy of Medicine and currently am chair of the advisory council for the Delaware Public Health Association. And my role as a practicing physician at Christiana Care, I still do maintain a practice. I very much enjoy seeing patients couple of days a week and being out and about to see how public health impacts their lives for the other parts of the week as well. And I also serve as the Enterprise Chief Scientific Officer for Christiana Care Health System. And I have a faculty appointment at the University of Delaware, with which I have a long affiliation having grown up here, including having taken courses there as an undergraduate. So again, thank you for having us.
Fantastic. Thank you both again for being here. So Sean, I'm going to kick it over to you to go ahead and get us started with our conversation.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Julia. And thanks, Dr. Khan and Tim, again, for joining us today. I wanted to start out by asking about a question related to housing. We know housing is a social determinant of health due to how it impacts things like our access to transportation, healthy food, schools, many other things. What are some examples in Delaware of how you've seen housing impact our public health?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that we need to perhaps take a step back from talking about housing as a dwelling and talk about place. Ironically, the next issue of the Delaware Journal of Public Health, which is our signature publication for the Academy DPHA, is dealing with this very issue. Place happens at the intersection of the natural and built environment, and as they intersect with social, economic, and political factors. So places might look identical and yet be profoundly different just because of other things that influence. Therefore, any housing that occurs, dwellings that occur in those places inherit and also influence the nature of the place in which they exist. So when we talk about housing and health outcomes, we are as much as anything talking about how location matters. And we've known for some time that zip code is a proxy for the types of determinants of health and health outcomes that we're going to see in an area. It gets very interesting in a densely populated area like, say, the city of Wilmington, where one zip code might encompass some very different types of places, some places that have a lot of wealth, great infrastructure, entertainment, park area, and other places across the railroad, so to speak, who do not enjoy those same privileges and have a very different set of outcomes. I think at this point, I would turn it over to Dr. Kahn and see what he might have to say about places it relates to dwellings.
Sure. Thank you so much, Tim. And please, everyone, please call me Omar as well. So everything Tim said makes so much sense. We need to look beyond the house just as a physical structure, but also recognizing the safety and security it provides as a physical structure and how, frankly, especially in the time of COVID, this is such an important conversation, right? Many folks have been essentially trapped in their homes, trapped in their houses. And so it's been incredibly important from a variety of perspectives. One thing we think about in terms of that is just safety of individuals being in their homes. You know, we don't think about it as much when we're joking about having to go to work every day, every weekday. But for some people, that can actually be the only refuge maybe that they had from an unsafe home. And so we're talking about a variety of ways that a house is not a safe home. And that can be environmental factors. They can be individual factors. There's so many ways that that can happen. So housing and health have never been as important as I think they are now. In general, I think of it kind of the same way as what's the inside of the house and what's the outside of the house and what the broader context is. Safe housing is one of the social determinants of health. That's how important it is. We know from research that certain things impact how long people live and how healthy they live. And one of those is, in fact, safe housing, as much so as perhaps education and employment. And in fact, housing impacts both of those things, right? Where the house is located matters what kind of education you get if it's public education. Where the house is located might matter how much where one shops and eats based on the healthy foods available close by or unhealthy things available nearby, such as liquor stores and cigarette stores that may be more plentiful than offering healthier foods. Where the house is located may matter in terms of employment, because if you don't have good public transport available close by, if getting home after dark is dangerous to walk to your home, then it may matter what kind of job you take. Where the house is located matters with regards to other services such as daycare. How do single parents have a job in this situation where education is subpar, post-education care is subpar for the children, and everything links back again to where you are? So place matters perhaps more than any other determinant of health. And that sounds like a bold statement, but I hope as we think about all of these that we can see that. The inside of the house piece, I think Tim covered it pretty well. I wouldn't add much to that in terms of environmental factors and so forth. The proximity of the house to everything else, I think, is something that we can continue to focus on. And frankly, in the clinical setting, we're challenged to figure out how the interplay of these factors work and how we can impact them. But the science behind why this is important is pretty clear.
Right. I think I would add too that, you know, as we think about the location and the environs, you know, is it swampland? You know, how much light and heavy industry is in the area? Are you approximate to interstates or to otherwise unsafe roads? You know, what level of access do neighborhoods have to safe level of access do neighborhoods have to other neighborhoods? Do neighborhoods and households have to sources of affordable, good quality food, education, recreation? One of the things that Delaware is increasingly blessed with are our greenways and our bike paths, such important components. But I do want to take a minute and sort of take a step back again to a fundamental reality that's happened through COVID-19 that I've observed, which is that, you know, we talk about country folk and city folk. And that's a very simple way of saying that we as the human animal do socialize at different levels. And some people are very content to be more solitary. Other individuals are much more community. They're much more gregarious. That's had an influence, an impact on how COVID-19 has played into how we have done from a psychological standpoint. Have we survived or have we thrived? I happen to be personally a person who loves solitude, and other people like my friend Omar is far more gregarious than I am. So we've each sort of approached COVID-19 and our own housing and work life in different ways. So what we're saying about all of this is always influenced by the type of people that you're talking about. So something that we see are in heavily populated areas, you can have individuals who still have a profound sense of isolation. And that has as much to do with their psychology, their relationship with their environment, with other people, as they have with where in particular they are. All to say that we can't talk about these in simple, straight line terms. There are a lot of subtleties and complexities to all of this. Coming from Canada, from the Midwestern part of Canada, it's flat, it's boring, it's cold. And that to me, at this time of year, sounds just about like heaven, because it is cold and solitary.
That's really interesting. Thank you both. I guess going back to Omar's comment too about sort of the research on, you know, that supports that, looking at the evidence that supports the impact of social determinants on our health, whether that's housing or other things and our environments. Is there specific data that you and your colleagues have seen more recently, like over the past several years, or are there data sets that are being collected now that are helping to look at those facts and look at the demographics of how how certain people have been impacted? I'm going to go back to the housing too, like specific to housing quality and housing costs. And I know there's, like Tim said, there's a lot to that. It's not just like the house you live in, but there's also the built environment where that, what zip code you're located in, all those different environments. Is there data that is being looked at here in Delaware, or that's part of a national data set that's relevant to you and your colleagues right now, or something that you're looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you, Julia. In terms of the national data on this, there are pretty clear, some of which comes from Delaware as well, some of which are nationally aggregated. So once we know the generalities around these data, replicating them in Delaware can be helpful because then we can come up with specific interventions. So let's talk about two or three just very specific areas. We covered a lot of ground in terms of the breadth of where housing plays a role. It plays a role in virtually everything. Well, let's maybe focus on one or two things. Environmental health is a relatively easy one. Air quality, water quality. So if you talk about air and environmental quality, children who have or are susceptible to asthma tend to have much worse outcomes when they are in homes which are in areas where there are more environmental triggers. That's an easy one. That data has been replicated in Delaware. We actually funded a very interesting project several years ago where our colleagues from Christiana Care in Moores put air quality monitors on the outside of the home, and they were linked by Wi-Fi to the parents' smartphones, so they could actually see the environmental triggers in real time at that point, the air quality around their home, not at Newcastle County Airport, not down in Sussex County, but around their home, and make adjustments based on that. And we were not surprised to find out their air quality varies a lot. And it is remarkably poor in underserved neighborhoods of, for example, of Wilmington. And so that's certainly an issue. So environmental triggers, that data are out there, that is very well established between that and asthma. The data around things like radon, for example, as a risk for lung cancer, everyone knows, you know, you go into a home, you get inspected, you look, do a radon test, you have radon detectors in the basement and so forth, because it comes up from the ground rock. But it's linked to lung cancer, and we don't need to replicate those data in Delaware to know that we need to be concerned about radon safety as well. Issues around lead paint are well established, and that's been done for many, 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 many years. The data in Delaware also tell us that access to safe neighborhoods for healthy neighborhoods for walking, for diet and exercise. Again, nationally, we know diet and exercise matter. In Delaware, we know that diet and exercise matter, and where we don't provide adequate access to both. When you have access to a healthy bike path, Delaware data show that those folks tend to be healthier. When you don't have access to them and you have more proximity to liquor stores and cigarette stores, we know there's higher sales of tobacco and higher consumption of alcohol in those neighborhoods. So we have Delaware-specific data that amplify and concentrate our national data for policy action right here. But here's the good news. Delaware is a lot like the rest of the country. In fact, that's what helps us be successful in large national federal research grants as well. We kind of look like the rest of the country. We're a microcosm of how we can study things. And as you all know from the University of Delaware, that then you can study and apply those and come up with local solutions that have global applicability to the entire country. So that's why I think the Delaware conversation is so relevant to the rest of the country. I'll turn it over to Tim for any other comments on that as well.
Right. Well, just a couple of other things come to mind. We're all familiar with the hazards of lead. And prior to lead, there was a lot of focus on asbestos, which was used back in the day in all sorts of residential and commercial applications, from siding to flooring, pipe wrap and whatnot. So that's one that we've over time done a really good job with. When we think about, you know, the triggers to asthma, one of the other triggers can be those mold spores and whatnot that exist within a dwelling or in the immediate area. Wet basements can be a problem for everyone, and it's not just a matter of inconvenience, and it's not a matter of we need to have major flooding to occur. It's simply having wet basements. So getting those managed and dealt with can have a really good impact on health outcomes for some people. We've learned over time that urethane foam and its many applications is not really a good thing to have in dwellings. So if you think about sort of from the underground up about what kind of things are in your environment, you can begin to consider, you know, what things should we be taking away or should we not be introducing to begin with?
That's all really interesting. I mean, and this happens a lot whenever we have conversations, Tim. It's interesting listening to you and your friends like Dr. Khan talk a lot about how a lot of these things interact with planning. You know, I have a background as a planner, a master's degree, and, you know, a lot of this stuff coincides. So part of the idea of planning that I think a lot of people miss a lot of the time is it's about more effective government spending and management. And, you know, I think a lot of this stuff also plays out through the medical field, through additional costs. So, you know, having said all that, wondering if you have thoughts on how medical professionals and planners and other advocates like housing advocates and professionals, you know, how can we do a better job of coordinating and working together kind of pursuing mutual interests because, you know, a lot of the things we work on seem to align at the end of the day.
You know, one of the things that I'm a big believer in starting at home. And one of the reasons that we are the Delaware Academy of Medicine, Delaware Public Health Association, a very long name, is to preserve the idea that two somewhat different disciplines, which COVID has definitely aligned and refined and illuminated the connection that we are two disciplines who work together. Our enthusiasm around the partnership with the Delaware chapter of the American Planning Association is reflective of the enthusiasm we have at working together. I'll turn it over to Omar to talk about the Delaware Health Science Alliance, in which I believe that a similar phenomenon occurs.
Very much so. Thank you, Tim, and thank you, Sean, for the question. I think in terms of us working together across disciplines, the first step is recognizing there's a reason to do that. And certainly with regards to medicine and public health, I think a global approach is helpful. In most other countries of the world, public health is, in fact, the larger overarching discipline, and medicine is the action arm of public health. Canada is a great example. Health Canada runs public health, but also runs medicine. Medicine is simply the action arm of public health. Medicine is part of public health. They're not distinct entities. When Tim and I sought to essentially create the Delaware Public Health Association many years ago, it was to not only become the Delaware affiliate of the American Public Health Association, but really start to, in Delaware, create the conversation about medicine and public health working together as integrated, highly overlapping entities for the good of the state, and perhaps even set up a national model. That was our very modest aim back then. I think we've succeeded. Mm-hmm. We've been asked at the national level to speak about this model and how our journal, which Tim mentioned, the Delaware Journal of Public Health, how that helps bring these issues to bear. So I think in terms of working together, the first step is recognizing we need to work together. The next step is figuring out what are we going to work on? And simultaneously, how do we, in fact, create the right incentives to be able to work for that? Everyone has different incentives for coming together to work on an issue. Some people do it. It's the right reason to do it. Other folks do it because, well, it's also financially advantageous to do it. Certainly, it shouldn't be financially disadvantageous. And in medicine, for example, much of that field has been driven by what we used to call the fee-for-service mentality. And fee-for-service is a real term. It means that when you go to see somebody, you pay for that service and then you leave. It is not that dissimilar to how shops work. You go to buy something, you pay money for it, you walk out with that thing. Well, but you can't walk out with health. That's the problem. You can walk out with a prescription, but you can't walk out with health. If you want to walk out with health from my office, then we have to partner the other 364 days as well, not just the one day you're in the office. And that's when you, me, Tim, Sean, Julia, we have to work together, take care of our community and say, you know what, if I care about your asthma, it has to be about prescribing you more than just the albuterol inhaler in the office today. It has to be about what is the air quality at home? What are the other stresses and triggers at home? And are you even able to afford the medication? So all of a sudden, you go from being a doctor to a health economist, to a finance person, to a health policy person, and no one person can do all of that. And guess what? You need a team. And that brings us to today's conversation. So I think you have to look at the bigger picture, look at what issue you want to solve, and create the right incentives to be able to solve it.
I think that the other thing I would add, and I don't mean to sound terribly provocative about this, but we do as a society have a little bit of a tendency to point fingers and say, no, that's somebody else's responsibility. Mm-hmm. And from the foundation sector to the state, to the healthcare institutions, to small institutions, and certainly to individuals in the general public, we're all responsible for our health and the health of others. That simply is the way it actually is. So pointing at, for instance, the Division of Public Health and saying, well, it's their problem, they're going to have to deal with it, is not only unrealistic, but it's a guaranteed setup to fail. DPH, any more than any other healthcare institution, can't fight these battles autonomously. It takes a team and it takes tremendous coordination and engagement, part of what I think podcasts like this today are very useful you know, teasing out the subtleties of connections between sectors. As long as we all go away with a win out of it, which is better health, a happier life, a sense of purpose and well-being, everyone will be happy.
I really appreciate both of you pointing out, you know, this is a team effort, and it takes people in medical doctors, public health professionals, researchers, community members, and community activists, and so many people to be a part of this. And it's really important. So I'm glad we're talking about that. I'm also glad that you mentioned the journal of the Delaware Journal of Public Health. I think that's really important asset to our state. And I know I've had the honor of being asked to be a contributor at one point. I wrote an article a couple of years ago, and it's amazing the amount of information that's covered, I think monthly, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Five issues a year with usually one supplement.
Okay, gotcha. What can we look forward to in an upcoming, is there a theme that is up and coming that you want to talk about? Or are there other projects that y'all are doing together or individually that you want to mention?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Julia. So I'm glad you mentioned the journals. I serve as editor-in-chief of the journal. Tim serves as publisher. And we have an amazing team of managing editors, copy editors, artists, everyone who makes it a success. One of the many unique things about the journal is that it is Delaware's only PubMed indexed peer-reviewed journal, djph.org. It is also dual open access, which is unusual. Sounds kind of a wonky thing to talk about, but it actually is very important because typical open access journals means you can read it for free, but the people who publish in it actually have to pay steep fees. And there's a lot written about this. They pay upwards of $2,000 to $3,000 to publish an article in a PubMed index journal. Tim and I believe that's not the great publishing model. It just shifts the burden from one side to another. And so we're very lucky to have endowments from the Academy and DPHA to be able to support the publication of the journal as a service. Frankly, not just to Delaware, but anybody on the planet with an internet connection can read it for free. And we welcome anyone to publish in it for free as well once it's been peer reviewed and accepted. So that's a dual open access model. In two ways, Delaware is actually leading the way globally. There are very few dual open access peer-reviewed PubMed index journals in the world. So thanks to authors like you, Julia, that's really important. Our upcoming work focuses on place and health. And as always, we knit together the stories of medicine and public health. We knit together stories of how frontline clinicians deal with these challenges. We bring together people to talk about really important things that may seem like they're very micro, what I just mentioned, asthma. You could take blood pressure as another example. It goes far beyond the doctor's office into a much broader conversation about to control the single person's blood pressure is not about prescribing the medication. That's about 20% we know from the evidence. 20% of how we improve somebody's health happens inside a hospital walls or clinic walls. We know this. 80% of it happens outside the clinic walls. So therefore, we try to balance everything we do, whether it's workforce development, whether it's educating our students and our residents and creating our workforce structures around that. We balance that now going forward and to look at that 80% as well. When we train medical doctors, we train them to think about the 80%, even though they are the experts in the 20%. So recognizing that context is really critical. And so that's kind of the range of things philosophically that we work on. I'll turn it over to Tim if he wants to amplify any in particular.
Mr. I was just pulling up the table of contents. I don't want to give away too much, but let's see here. We have Partnership for Healthy Communities, Healthy Communities Delaware, What Shapes Living with HIV, People Living with HIV's Experience in Delaware, a piece from Dr. Tam down at BB Healthcare talking about the changing landscape of healthcare and the need to focus on local geography. So that gives you a flavor, and that's what we strive for, is for one thing, not to be Newcastle County focused. That's where we all are, but we aspire to be the state's Academy of Medicine and Public Health Association, not just Newcastle County's. And, you know, another thing I want to say about the journal, it's a labor of love, and it is a labor. When you said 12 times a year, my heart may have stopped momentarily, But in any event, it is a continuous activity, and we're always thinking about, you know, what's coming down the pike, and we're prepared to pivot to respond to emergent situations. Certainly, COVID-19 emerged a couple of years ago, and we did a big pivot around that. We've all done big pivots around that. The other piece of work that I do want to, since you offered that we could talk about something, one of the quote unquote smaller portions of the social determinants of health is health and healthcare access. We were commissioned by the state of Delaware, the Department of Labor, with ARPA funding to undertake a really unique workforce study. That's going to be coming out within the next month. We're the first state in the country, perhaps arguably crazy enough, to attempt to do what we've done, which is to look at every licensed individual in Delaware, whether they're a nurse, a speech language pathologist, a physician, a funeral director, a massage and bodywork person, and so on. Look at where they are, their gender, what their age is, which can be an indicator of when they're going to retire. And look at this very comprehensively and juxtapose that against chronic disease states and information from the University of Delaware's Center for Demography and also population studies. Sussex County, Delaware is growing rapidly, and we do not have yet the resources down there to take care of where the population is going. Rather than think about it as an, oh my God, the sky is falling, let's think about it as a wonderful opportunity. Sussex County, from the beaches to the inland, is a beautiful location. We do need to change our context and our framework and our language around what's opportunity as opposed to what's, you know, some horrible situation. Sussex County is going to grow no matter what. We have the opportunity now to respond. Same too up here in Newcastle County. There are areas, there are great opportunities for growth. And so just as we had the enterprise zone, enterprise communities for business and for redevelopment and revitalization back in the day, we've got opportunity zones for healthcare and healthcare outcomes. So excited to get that out there into the world and let people look at the data and start independently coming up with their own recommendations. Ours has been to sort through the data to analyze it. It's the responsibility for everyone to come together and make recommendations that are actionable and reasonable.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much. And I do look forward to hearing more about that specific work, the project you mentioned, Tim, and then also your next, the next journal publication when it comes out. So we're really, really, again, just thankful that you were able to talk with us today, given your busy schedules. And we certainly look forward to continuing these kinds of conversations with both of you in the future. There's lots of still to talk about. Sean, anything else before we wrap up?
The only thing I'd say is I just want to give a little plug. We are about to wrap up a draft that we've been working on. We got a small project that was funded by the three Habitat for Humanity chapters in the state and in partnership with the Center for Community Research and Service. You know, we've put together it's a healthy housing study for homeowner occupied housing throughout the state. So primarily looking at, you know, the cost to upgrade substandard homeowner occupied housing to where we would like it. And through the process of doing that, talk to people kind of throughout the state, and there are a variety of issues throughout the state. So I'll be interested to check out that article from Dr. Tam and the upcoming journal, because that aligns, you know, a fair bit with what our study's finding too.
What are the closing things I would mention there, Sean, in response to what you were just talking about? We do spend a lot of time thinking about cost, the expense of doing things. I would argue that just as we're underscoring opportunity rather than deficit, we think about the value of doing things. So I know we're each comfortable with our own words, and we are understandably a necessary, a very, very, you know, financially focused society. But it's the value that we get out of investing this money. That's where the real bang for the buck is.
I'll just add that from my perspective to end my piece of the conversation is I like thinking about things and I like doing things about them as part of a team. And one of the ways we have done that in Delaware, which I think should be relevant to all of your audiences from tip to toe, we have focused our energies around one of the areas I work in, medical workforce, to include areas which we're talking about today, which includes housing and public health. Delaware is very fortunate. We have several family medicine residency programs between soon to be BB, Bay Health, Christiana Care, St. Francis, and wonderful primary care programs in pediatrics at Nemours. All of these programs have transformed the last 10 to 15 years to include conversations when we're training family doctors on housing, homelessness, on healthcare in the much broader context. And there are several partnerships I can highlight perhaps in a future conversation, but I really want to give kudos to our partners and our colleagues across the state as part of the alliance, BB, Bay Health, the University of Delaware, Nemours, Christiana Care, the Delaware Academy of Medicine, and our partner medical schools, Thomas Jefferson University and the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. These folks all care deeply about health and public health in Delaware. Even when, quote unquote, we train a doctor, a family doctor, to be in the clinic, we're actually training them to be the convener, the discussant in public health conversations of the future. So to that degree, I think conversations like ours take us much further along than just one podcast or 1 hour. They really are amplifying across the state. And in Delaware, we have the power to change things and be a national model, as we've talked about. So thank you again for facilitating this conversation. And I hope we have some more like it. And again, impact lies for the positive in our fine state.
Thank you so much. Well, we'll look forward to talking with you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning into this episode. To learn more about the Delaware Academy of Medicine and the Delaware Public Health Association, please visit delamed.org. That's DELAMED.org. And to find out more about IPA's health and social policy work and housing-related work, please visit ipa.udel.edu.